What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. China has announced that beginning Tuesday will halt the import of North Korean coal, iron ore, and seafood in the wake of the latest UN Security Council resolution over the North's banned nuclear missile programs. China is Pyongyang's largest trading partner, but Tufts University analyst Sung-Yun Lee doesn't think it amounts to much.
I think China will make some gestures, cut down, scale back on the import of seafood and iron, but there's really no way to verify, monitor these things, these human economic activities. So I don't think this is groundbreaking news.
Monday, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un said he'd watch for actions by the U.S. before ordering the launch of missiles into waters near the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam. In Colombia, Vice President Mike Pence maintained the U.S. policy priority is a denuclearized Korean peninsula.
We're putting all of the resources of the United States and the energies of this president behind an effort to resolve this present confrontation with North Korea peaceably. But as the president has said, all options are on the table. And as our Secretary of State has said, there is no future for the regime in Pyongyang with the possession of nuclear weapons.
U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, meanwhile, vowed Monday to take out any missile launched toward Guam. Unidentified gunmen Monday attacked a U.N. peacekeeping base in the northern Malian city Timbuktu, killing 7, including 5 Malian security guards. Several were wounded. In a separate incident, a peacekeeper was killed in an attack by armed men on U.N. and Malian personnel in Duenza in central Mali. This is VOA News. Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, addressing supporters Monday, denounced U.S. threats of military action against his government and called for preparations for an imperialist invasion. Mr. Maduro said this homeland will not be intimidated and will not be defeated by anyone. Last week, President Donald Trump said he could not rule out military action as the South American country's economic, social, and political crisis deepens. Vice President Mike Pence said the U.S. would, with its Latin American allies, bring the full measure of America's diplomatic and economic power to bear until Venezuelan democracy is restored. President Trump ordered his trade office Monday to investigate whether China is stealing American intellectual property.
Today I'm directing the United States Trade Representative to examine China's policies, practices, and actions with regard to the forced transfers of American technology and the theft of American intellectual property.
Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer will have a year to investigate the alleged Chinese theft of American technology and intellectual property. China's Ministry of Commerce Tuesday warned China would react to defend its interests if the U.S. damages trade ties. In Kenya, many ignored an opposition call for a one-day strike following last week's election that saw President Uhuru Kenyatta's Jubilee coalition return to power. The Kenyan leader Monday called on the opposition to use legal mechanisms and demonstrations to air its grievances.
But I truly believe that there is no single Kenyan anywhere who wants to continue to see violence, looting, and demonstrations that end up destroying property.
Mr. Kenyatta was officially declared winner of the hotly contested race Friday, but post-election violence left more than 20 dead. Opposition leader Raila Odinga has charged widespread fraud, although international election observers said the ballot was generally free and fair. The U.S. Central Command says an Iranian drone without warning lights came within 300 meters of the U.S. aircraft carrier Nimitz in international waters of the Persian Gulf late Sunday during flight operations. It called the drone's approach unsafe and unprofessional. Zimbabwe's vice president, seen as a possible successor to 93-year-old President Robert Mugabe, has been hospitalized in South Africa, suffering apparently from food poisoning. 74-year-old Emmerson Mnangagwa was airlifted to South Africa, missing Heroes Day celebrations in Harare. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, marking the anniversary of Japan's World War II surrender Tuesday, sent a ritual offering to the controversial Yasukuni Shrine for the nation's war dead, but avoided a personal appearance. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone focuses on search and rescue following Monday's massive mudslide.
There is still quite a lot of work in digging these submerged buildings and try to locate people. So it would be unwise for me at this stage to give you any precise figures. Government will be in a position to give those figures when emergency services have finished doing their work.
Bokari Stevens is Sierra Leone's ambassador to the United States. A new referendum in Mauritania gives the president more power after abolishing the Senate. Nigeria's military boosts security amid upsurge in Boko Haram attacks. And Kenyan election officials say candidates not pleased with last week's election results must go to the courts.
We could challenge the election in court, yeah, and we will provide them with all the results, and we will look at them, and it will be up to the court to decide, yes.
Andrew Limo is the spokesperson for the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. South Sudan's parliament suspends debate on the country's next fiscal year budget, and Burundian youth form clubs to improve their English. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Authorities in Sierra Leone say they are concentrating on search and rescue and providing medical support to a community outside the capital Freetown that was hit by a giant mudslide early Monday. There are conflicting accounts in terms of the number of fatalities. One account attributed to the Red Cross in Sierra Leone say as many as 205 bodies have been recovered. Another report attributed to the French news agency said the death toll had risen to 312 and over 2,000 people wounded. Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma said his heart was heavy by what he called this national tragedy. The president said the government and development partners had established an emergency response center to provide relief to survivors. Bokari Stevens is Sierra Leone's ambassador to the United States. He says the country is still trying to come to grip with the magnitude of the tragedy.
Essentially, we've been hit by a tragedy unimaginable proportions. We are in a Regent village, which is one of the hillside villages surrounding Freetown, followed by heavy downpour of torrential rain. I think it eroded the foundation of Mount Sugarloaf, which is patched on top of Regent. And the mud fell on buildings and killed quite a lot of people. The long and short is we've had an emergency, we've had a tragedy that is well beyond what we'll never have thought could have happened to our country.
We are getting conflicting figures in terms of the number of fatalities. One account said 205 people might have been killed. Another said about 312 people. What does your government know?
All the emergency services have been deployed in these areas. And there is still quite a lot of work in digging these submerged buildings and try to locate people. So it would be unwise for me at this stage to give you any precise figures. Government will be in a position to give those figures when the emergency services have finished doing their work. But suffice it to say that it is a tragedy beyond what we ever would have thought to happen to my country.
Mr. Ambassador, if my memory serves me right, this is the second year in a row that your country, let's say the city of Freetown, has been hit by flood. Is there a building code in your city, in your country, that can prevent this kind of thing? Or do you think this is just a case of climate change that's causing it?
The laws are there. Whether they are followed or whether they are not followed is something else. But the laws are there for a building code or for have a building permit and make sure that you construct buildings within the parameters of the law. Whether it is adhered to is a different thing. But let me say, no matter whatever we can do, you cannot fight against nature. I mean, I give you the example of New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina. America is the greatest nation on earth. And when that hurricane came, it killed so many people, they could not withstand it. So no matter what we do, this is natural disaster. Of course, that doesn't mean that we should not do more.
As you said, your government is having meetings in terms of how to respond. What do you normally do in a case like this to the people who probably are being left homeless? Does the government take care of those people?
The government does take care of them. I mean, whether for good or for bad, I believe we have had experiences of the Ebola. We have had experiences of previous flood. And systems have been put in place to meet with this kind of emergencies. With the Ebola in 2014, we had very rigid systems which allowed us to be able to deal with that emergency within a reasonable period of time. There is now an emergency center set up in Regent Village, and there are also reporting centers in the three affected areas, in both in Regent, in Lumley, and in Ross Road. Centers have been set up wherein people can go and check about their relatives, and they are also taking down numbers.
Mr. Ambassador, so nice to have you on Daybreak Africa, and thank you very much again.
Thank you very much, sir.
Bukari Stevens is Sierra Leone's ambassador to the United States. He was speaking with me from Washington. Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission has presented election-related documents to the main opposition party, the National Super Alliance, also known as NASA, led by former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. The main opposition coalition requested to review the documents after rejecting the outcome of last Tuesday's presidential election. Odinga's coalition says the election was rigged in favor of incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta and his ruling Jubilee coalition. Meanwhile, Odinga says he would announce the party's strategy to dispute the election results today, Tuesday. Andrew Limo, spokesperson for the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that those displeased with the poll outcome can seek legal redress in the court.
We could challenge the election in court, yeah, and we will directly provide them with all the results, and they will look at them, and it will be up to the court to decide, yes.
So, Andrew, both local and international poll observers who monitor the elections were pleased with the way the IEBC organized the election. How does the IEBC feel about organizing this August 8th election last week?
I think this is the most challenging of all the processes, considering that we had a lot of court cases. There were always very many challenges and problems. Quite a number of changes into the law, quite late in the operation, and all that were quite a tremendous impact on our processes. But I think it was a determination for resilience among the staff. People wanted to prove something. They wanted to say, we're not as bad as you people say. We will demonstrate, and we know we mean well for this country. And I think they've done that, yes.
Unfortunately, quite a number of people, at least 10 so far, have been reportedly killed as a result of the election due to violence, although sporadic. How does the IEBC feel about this, despite the fact that you receive plaudits from both local and international poll observers about how transparent and credible the elections were?
Yeah, I know any poll outcome will have people who will be happy about it, others will be grieved about it. It's unfortunate that that happened. It's regrettable. And the commission would not like to have any death associated with the elections. And so it's also sad for us. I mean, we feel bad about it.
The voters went to the poll peacefully. After the election, what message is the IEBC sending to Kenyans who voted peacefully?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges that we have had is that there are two things. Quite often people don't understand the process, and it takes an effort to be able to explain. For example, there's this view that the electronic results, what comes, people think that when it is manipulated, you still have the paper records, the paper trail. And so the results are actually signed by agents at the polling station. There are hard copy papers of the same, and this is where we get the electronic results. And so it's a reflection of what has been decided by the people, and they put it on paper. Secondly, I think one of the most challenging issues is the issue of fake news. There are many people who manipulate information, shoot their hands, and it gets a problem because people tend to believe the way they put this, and that's been a big problem, not only for us, but most institutions. And I think the rise of social media, and where everybody has an opportunity to publish, and there's nobody in control, it has become a problem.
Andrew Limo is the spokesperson for Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 15th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A new referendum in Mauritania abolishes the Senate and consolidates more power into the hands of President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz. The president tied the referendum to the issue on changing the flag to honor soldiers who died in the fight for independence. Noel Foster, author of Mauritania, The Struggle for Democracy, spoke to Ricky Stryak about what this shakeup means for the country and how combining the issue of the flag change into the same referendum as the Senate issue was seen as a manipulative move.
Well, his critics would ascribe it to a desire to distract voters by playing to national sentiment. The modifications to the flag were to add two red stripes to symbolize the blood of martyrs shed in an anti-colonial fight against the former colonial ruler, France. But again, his critics will see this, as a result of this, as an attempt to distract from the political content.
And that political content would be that they've abolished now the Senate. How does this increase the power of the president?
The Senate, along with the National Ombudsman, the High Islamic Council, were the only bulwarks against the president's influence. And even though the Senate was largely composed of presidential loyalists in his Union for the Republic, or UPR party, it voted against his constitutional reform. With the Senate now abolished and replaced by regional councils, and with voting power now solely in the lower house, the National Assembly, President Ould Abdelaziz has little to constrain him. It's important to note that when the vote first came up in the National Assembly, about 141 out of 147 members voted for him. Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz has an absolute majority in this National Assembly, and the concern of many in Mauritania is that this will allow him to push through further constitutional amendments. He himself was quoted as stating that in 2 years' time, perhaps additional constitutional amendments would be made for the needs of the country, in his words.
And I believe one of the concerns is that one of those amendments would allow him to run for what is now unconstitutional third term.
Exactly. Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz came to power as a colonel in 2008 through a coup d'etat. He was elected first in 2009 and then re-elected in 2014. His prime minister, Yahya Ul-Hamedine, has been quoted as stating that the president, in order to accomplish this mission, requires a third term, something Ul-Hamedine later denied. But there is this sense, particularly amongst Ould Abdelaziz's critics, that he is searching for a third term.
How likely is it that Western allies would criticize that move if he is an ally against the fight against terrorism?
Abdelaziz was able to convert himself from a military junta leader into a civilian president by election. In that process, has had the support of the international community. So it stands to reason that in the event of a third term, Abdelaziz might believe he would have the support of the aid donor community, to include the United States and the European Union. He would be ill-advised to overestimate his utility. He is unpopular, it would seem, within his own country.
That was Noel Foster, author of Mauritania, The Struggle for Democracy. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Estonia. Since April this year, Boko Haram has carried out more than 100 attacks in the northeastern Nigerian city of Maiduguri. But efforts are underway to secure the city, including the relocation of military chiefs to Maiduguri. Chika Odua reports from Abuja.
In the past week, the Nigerian military has carried out a cordon and search operation for fleeing members of the armed terrorist group Boko Haram. The head of the operation said more than 30 houses were searched, based on information that high-level Boko Haram suspects had infiltrated an area in Maiduguri. Maiduguri, the Borno State capital, is the birthplace of Boko Haram. The state remains the epicenter of the group's insurgency, which began in 2009. Several parts of the state have seen a spike in Boko Haram attacks in the past 6 months. Intelligence Officer Lieutenant Aliko Ibrahim El-Rashid told VOA there have been at least 37 attacks in Maiduguri and nearby areas in the past 2 weeks, and more than 100 in the past 6 months. He says the weather has contributed to the sharp increase because the Air Force and Navy can't conduct effective patrols during the rainy season. El-Rashid says another big factor is local support for the group.
The issue that we are having with Maiduguri, the Boko Haram have substantial level of local support and they also have some sympathizers. Let me just tell you the fact. If you count 1, 2, 3 houses in Maiduguri, the third one, definitely one of that household member is a member of Boko Haram.
In response, military chiefs deployed to Maiduguri 2 weeks ago following orders by Nigeria's acting president, Yemi Osinbajo. One of the properties searched in the recent raids included a UN-rented residential property. Workers of several humanitarian organizations use the compound known as Red Roof. After the searches, the Nigerian military stated that no arrests were made, no suspects were found. The building had been at the center of rumors that the commander of Boko Haram, Abubakar Shekau, was hiding in a building called Red Roof. He released a video last month claiming that he is in Maiduguri. Also last month, Nigeria's Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Tukur Buratai, issued a 40-day deadline to capture Shekau, dead or alive. The order seems to contradict numerous past reports alleging the Nigerian military had already killed Shekau. That's Brigadier General Sani Usman, the Director of Army Public Relations, speaking to journalists.
Nobody has ever said on the part of the military, especially the Nigerian Army, said Shekau was dead. The deadline for the capture of Shekau, either dead or alive, will be accomplished.
Across Maiduguri, residents have noticed the increased presence of Nigerian military personnel. Convoys containing military service chiefs can often be seen on the streets. Chika Odua for VOA News in Abuja, Nigeria.
South Sudan's parliament on Monday suspended debate on the country's next fiscal year budget due to questions over the source of financial resources for various budget items. Lawmakers say they are outraged over the lack of accountability by spending agencies. Waket Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
A report by the Finance and Economic Planning Committee was tabled as MPs questioned the spending practices of certain government agencies over the past year. Thousands of government workers have not been paid their salaries for several months. And the Ministry of Electricity and Dams was found to have overspent last year's fiscal budget by 49%. No ruling was passed for a third reading of the budget because the vast majority of ministers were absent during debate, making it impossible to answer MPs' questions regarding last year's budget allocations. Speaker Anthony Lino Makana called off the debate, demanding that all ministers be present during the next session to answer MPs' questions.
I'm going to make a list of the ministers who are not attending. We are going to put them up there.
The lawmakers had been debating a 2017-2018 fiscal year budget amount of 70 billion South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent of $438 million. Last month, Finance Minister Stephen Diu Dau presented a 46 billion South Sudanese pound annual budget, but after studying budget allocations further, the Parliament's Committee on Finance and Economic Planning proposed an additional 24.8 billion South Sudanese pounds, bringing the total to 70 billion South Sudanese pounds. Several lawmakers, including Meridi State's Mary Nawai, asked why certain agencies are allocated tens of thousands of pounds, yet the agencies neither performed their duties nor provided specific accounts of how their funds were spent.
What were the activities that they used the budget for? These days, honorable members are working in different places, footing, and they are interacting with the people of the Republic of South Sudan. In this case, right, Honorable Speaker, we have never seen any sign in this country of electricity. What people are using are generators in their houses and solars.
This year's budget is three times the size of last year's budget, but it is not at all clear how the budget will be financed. David Nailo-Mayo, chairperson of the Committee of Finance and Economic Planning, says when inflation is taken into account, this year's budget is roughly the equivalent of last year's. He acknowledges that due to the ongoing fighting, revenues are down.
We are in war. Oil wells are in the West Bank of the Nile are closed. Only the oil wells in Dar are the ones operating and does not bring all the money that the nation would have required.
Speaker Makana says in the next session, lawmakers will demand to see all the ministers in the August House for an explanation and to present accountability reports for the 2016-2017 budget spending. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Burundian youths are forming English clubs to enhance their English-speaking skills. The move is part of an effort by the youths and Burundian professionals to feel more a part of the East African community labor market. Moses Aviarimana has the story from Bujumbura.
If you really want to discover who you are...
Sharing life experiences is among the benefits of this English club in Chibitoki, located a few kilometers from the capital city, Bujumbura. In Burundi, youths have started English clubs to enhance their English skills, mainly through organizing debates and drama. Burundi is a French-speaking country, but ever since the country joined the East African community, language has been a major impediment for their country's integration into the regional body. Vicky Kuwayo is the founder of one of the English clubs.
Yeah, this English club is actually very important because it helps bring together the young people from different quarters, from different neighborhoods. So they are brought together with only one mission, one goal, to learn English.
More than 60% of the estimated 10 million Burundians are youth. However, about 80% of them are unemployed. Since the country joined the East African community in 2007, Burundians are still struggling to penetrate the labor market as the community's common market protocol eases the free movement of services and labor in the region. East African universities have now opened branches in the country in efforts to promote English language. Isaac Maragia is a Kenyan and the director of one of the universities in Bujumbura.
As an English teaching university, we saw a serious challenge in the use of English. So we wanted to make it known to the people of Burundi that we were providing studies in English. And we also extended this opportunity to other universities.
Isabel Nahayo is the Burundi minister in charge of East African Community Affairs.
As you know, English is an official language of the community, so it's good for Burundians to learn English. To ease the implementation of the common market, which is in place already in the East African community. We encourage youth to learn English to be competitive in business and also in the labor market.
The East African Community Common Market Protocol allows the free movement of services and labor, but some partner states are still skeptical to open up their job markets for fear of competition in the region. With about 80% of the Burundian youth unemployed, learning English remains a priority for the country as Burundi remains the only French-speaking country in the East African community. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
And that's it for this Tuesday, August 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa to have a very, very good day.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.